Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You know it's me when I come through your town.
Well, today on the Brian Lehrer Show, it's a family meeting about risk. And let's play a game right at the outset. What do you think are the top 10 riskiest jobs in the United States? The 10 jobs with the biggest chances that you will actually get killed while at work. Call up and take your best guess. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Will some of you do that right now? Just call up and help us create a list, and we'll see what you think are the riskiest jobs in America compared to the actual list that we'll reveal in a couple of minutes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. What jobs in the United States do you think are in the top 10 for getting you killed, actually killed, while at work? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Don't overthink it. Just call up and take your best guess. Let's build a list of what you think are the top 10 riskiest jobs in America. Name one job that you think would be on that list, measured by the odds that you'll get killed while on the clock. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, I'll say again that this is a special edition of the Brian Lehrer Show today, a family meeting about risk. For example, why do some people become police officers and live with the risk that they could get shot by a bad guy at any moment? In a little while, we'll take calls from police officers specifically and former officers and your loved ones about why you did and how you cope. Another question, have we taken too much risk out of playtime with consequences for child development? Or is the backlash to that, the backlash to child safety of all things, the silliest thing you've ever heard? And another, why do we perceive some things as much riskier than they are and some as much safer than they are? Also, as a nation of immigrants, we are a nation of risk takers. The risk averse stay home. We'll hear some of your risk versus benefit immigration stories. And we'll invite you to compare stories today with Alex Bloomberg from the podcast Startup about risking your life savings to start your own business.
How much debt are we in?
Oh, God. Are you going to put this in the podcast? All I will say is that we are in more debt than I have ever been in my life.
Alex Bloomberg and producer Nazanin from Startup, Alex Bloomberg, coming up later. But let's begin with that top 10 list of America's riskiest jobs, as measured by the odds that you'll actually get killed while on the clock. Let's see what you think is on that top 10 list. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Saul in the Financial District. Hi, what do you think is on the list?
I think it's going to be... Top one is going to be either lumberjack type people or the high seas fishermen, those type of, like from the movie The Perfect Storm.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. Bill in Manhattan, what do you think is on the list?
I know what's on the list. Driving a bus in New York City.
Really? Well, we'll see if it's on the list. Dean on the North Fork of Long Island, what do you think is on the list?
Yeah, taxi driver or anything driving related.
Thank you very much. Philip in Rego Park, what do you think is on the list?
I know the farmer operated a bigger machine. I heard something in the news. That's true.
Uh-huh. Farmers operating heavy machinery. Alice in Westchester, what do you think is on the list?
Actually, I was going with farmers and construction workers.
Okay. Peter in Nyack, what do you think is on the top 10 list?
Yeah, I think my answers have already been given. Deep-sea fishing, mining, and cab driver. Cab driver in particular.
Okay. Anderson in Midtown, what do you think is on the list?
Yes, I also believe that driving any capacity in an urban area, such as Manhattan, for example, is a huge risk for your life. That's what I do, and I just can't take it anymore. I'm going to definitely leave soon.
Because of crashing?
No, it's just too stressful. I'm getting to the point that I cannot take it driving in Manhattan anymore.
Thank you very much. Good luck. And Andy in Ozone Park, what do you think is on the list? Top 10 most likely to die from jobs. Andy, are you there? No, Andy. How about Mac in Long Beach. Mac, what do you think is on the list?
Hi, Brian. I would vote for window cleaner.
Window cleaner. All right. Well, there we have some things. Oh, Debbie in Woodmere. Debbie, what do you think is on the list?
Definitely police officers and firemen. I think number one would be police officers.
Thank you very much. Alec in Riverdale, what do you think is on the list?
Yes, firefighter and police officer.
Thank you. And Mike on the Upper West Side, what do you think is on the list?
Hi, Brian. Yes, underwater welders and
that's
I believe they're
specific.
Called hot shots.
What are hot shots?
I think that's what they call them. The gentlemen that are the teams that fly in to fight forest fires, they're airdrop.
Yeah.
And they go in and they're behind the line, so to speak.
Thank you very much. All right, let's leave that there. That's a blink test on what some of you think are on the top 10 riskiest jobs list. Thanks for playing. Now we'll find out the real answers from Martin Colley, Chief Regional Economist at the Bureau of Labor Statistics here in New York. Hi, Martin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me. And you've got some interesting responses. And Saul, I think your first one actually nailed the first two jobs, and those are logging workers and fishing and related workers. Those are extremely dangerous. They we calculate what we call a fatality rate, which is the number of fatalities you get on the job for 100,000 full-time workers. And for logging workers, it's 91.3. So
the American job you are most likely to die at before coming home for dinner is like being a lumberjack, cutting down trees.
That's right. And fishing and working on fishing vessels is a close second.
So let's linger on this for a minute. That stat that you gave, 91 per 100,000 for logging workers. Does that mean that for every 100,000 loggers in the United States, 91 of them die each year?
That's what it basically does mean. And in 2013, there were 59 fatalities. So we did not have 100,000 full-time loggers, but that's the idea.
But that was the rate.
We had 59 logging workers who died on the job.
That's staggeringly high. I mean, if 91 people got killed in terrorist attacks here every year, we would turn the world upside down trying to stop it. We'd invade countries and kill thousands of their citizens. We'd curtail civil liberties. We'd declare war. But if that many people are dying in their lumberjack shirts, why aren't we declaring war on wood?
Well, Brian, you know, I work for this Bureau of Labor Statistics, and we just measure things. And we leave it to people like you and to elected officials to decide what we should be doing with this information. But
all right, so wait a minute. So we better bring in then. Our other guest, Les Bowden, professor of public health at Boston University. Hi, Professor Bowden. Welcome to WNYC.
Good morning. Thank you. Glad to be there.
There's a risk perception question here, isn't there? Why isn't it in the news all the time if 91 out of every 100,000 loggers in America each year die on the job?
That's a very good question that I wish I knew the answer to. It would seem that it would be much more in the news than it actually is. I think that people just avoid their eyes, and politicians don't want to deal with it because a lot of the way of dealing with it is regulation, and you know how popular regulation is.
Right. All right. Well, we're going to come back to your expertise in risk and risk perception as a public health professor and talk through some of the psychological factors as well as social psychological factors that make us misperceive risk and do too little about some risks and do too much about some other risks. But let me go back to Martin Colley from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. We've got that number one risky job on the table now, lumberjacks. By the way, do you know why? Do you look at this at the Bureau of Labor Statistics? Why logging is so dangerous? I think by now they may have figured out how to cut down a tree without getting people killed.
Well, Brian, I don't know if you've ever worked outside in cold weather on slippery conditions with heavy equipment.
Lucky to say I have not.
but many of our dangerous jobs, fishing, logging, some construction workers, roofers, they are working basically in hazardous conditions where they're working with dangerous equipment. They're working at height sometimes. They're working on, icy surfaces at times. It is dangerous work. But I'm not sure if you asked this question or not, but I wanted to make another point about sort of a job that's dangerous but not doesn't fall into this sort of outside kind of thing. And the third most dangerous job in the U.S., which is something that nobody guessed, was aircraft pilots. And there are a lot of small planes still go down. And
I was just going to get to that. Number three, aircraft pilot and flight engineers at 50 per 100,000 every year. Really? I mean, I thought we almost never have a commercial plane crash here, maybe one every few years.
We do have very few commercial plane crashes, but we do have a lot of small planes that crash. And you know,
so these are recreational pilots? Because this is a jobs list.
They could be flying private jets.
They could be for-hire pilots flying private jets.
Yes.
Which means that the risk of flying in a small plane is pretty darn high.
It is. It's compared to flying United and your regulated public carriers.
Yeah.
Other things that were on there were roofers, which is the fifth job, the fourth job.
Roofers is number four. That makes sense.
It's five, actually, but the four is something we called other extraction workers, which would be other people involved in mining and oil and gas drilling that we don't break out separately.
Do you have it yet for fracking, or is it too new?
We don't actually have a separate job for fracking, but the mining industries are generally dangerous. You're again sort of working with heavy equipment. Mines are dangerous places. They collapse. They blow up.
And then number five, as I'm looking at your list, is refuse and recyclable materials collectors.
Right.
33 per 100,000. Does that mean sanitation workers, garbage men?
They could be included in that, but also people who work in recycling plants, sorting recyclables, feeding recyclables into machines that sort of melt things down.
Really? That's dangerous? We thought recycling was so wholesome.
Well, it might be a good thing to do, but it, as you said before, it might involve risks.
How do they die in recycling plants? Do you know?
There are issues of machinery, and you're feeding basically recycled glass and plastics into machines that are sort of processing them down, cutting them up, melting them. And
wow. And how about sanitation workers themselves?
Sanitation workers would be tracked here, and there have been cases where sanitation workers in the city have died on the job. I actually don't remember some of the details right now, but again,
they don't fall into the trucks, do they?
I would hope not. But again, that's a job that can be outside. It can involve heavy equipment. It's dangerous.
By the way, spoiler alert, police officer is not on your top 10 list. Firefighter is not on your top 10 list. You're telling us it's riskier to go to work every day in a recycling plant than it is as a cop.
I wouldn't actually want to say that. I mean, I can understand why you do that. But what happens many times with protective service jobs is that there will sometimes be violent incidents where you have a lot of people die. So last year, a lot of firefighters died in this fire in Arizona, and you might have years that go by without a lot of firefighters dying. And we have statistics for non-fatal injuries, and the protective service occupations show up fairly high there with a lot of non-fatal work injuries. And certainly being a police officer and being a fireman can be a very dangerous job. It just doesn't always result in disproportionate numbers of fatalities.
And as we talk about the riskiest jobs in terms of getting killed on the job, going over the top 10 list with Martin Colley from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, then comes mining machine operators, I can only imagine, but then you have drivers. This says, your published document here says sales workers.
Yeah.
And truck drivers.
Right.
Being a traveling salesman is the seventh most dangerous job in America?
You have a lot of delivery things where you basically have a truck, you deliver stuff, and outside of New York City, transportation is a sector with a lot of fatalities. Driving, you know, many people are driving under bad conditions, poor visibility, slick roads. It can be dangerous. New York City, we have relatively fewer transportation fatalities, and we have more
Vision Zero.
Well, we haven't reached Vision Zero yet, as far as I know. But
as policy. But is it just that it's such a dense city, and it's hard to drive really fast, so when there are crashes, they don't tend to be fatal as often?
That could be. But the rest of the country is much more reliant on trucks and cars to get stuff delivered and for people to get around than we are in New York. What happens with some of the drivers in New York City, not so much in 2013, but going back to the 90s, you had a number of cases where delivery drivers would be held up and shot, you know, especially in the Bronx. And it was a you had several of your call-in people who identified drivers as a dangerous occupation, and it is. And it's not just transportation accidents.
So if police kick Mayor de Blasio out of Gracie Mansion, maybe he can become transportation secretary and help the country with Vision Zero in the 50 states. All right, to round out the top 10 riskiest jobs in America, as measured by your risk of actually dying on the job, are number 8, farmers and ranchers. Number 9, electrical power line installers and repairers. Those make sense, the heavy farm
outside
machinery and up on the poles there. And number 10, construction workers, which, again, makes sense. We had Gay Talese on the show, the writer, who did a book 50 years ago when they completed the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. And one of the things in the book was the high risk of dying as a construction worker on the Verrazano Narrows Bridge.
The George Washington Bridge, 7 died. Down the Verrazano Bridge, only 3 died. But after the third death, the union, 40, Local 40, insisted on nets. And twice this Robert Walsh, who is still alive and active as the manager of the union, he fell. And, of course, he lives to tell about it. But many who were unlucky are not with us as chroniclers of the bridge.
And if we go even further back, even more died building the Brooklyn Bridge. So construction worker, dangerous job.
It's a very dangerous job. And some of the things we've talked about, many of these people are working at heights. They're at risk of falling. Sometimes you're working outside in the cold weather, slippery surfaces. Sometimes you're working with equipment. And in New York City, construction has often been the industry with a lot of fatalities. And it's a dangerous industry nationally, and it's a dangerous industry in the city.
Professor Bowden, be patient. We're going to get back to you in a minute for some of these risk perception questions. But with Martin Colley from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, those are the top 10 nationally. You also have stats for New York City.
Right.
The latest year you have for New York City is 2013.
Right.
In that year, 160 people in New York City got killed on the job at work. I don't think many of them were loggers or farmers. So can we quickly go through some of the deadliest New York City jobs?
Actually, I have a slightly different number than you do, Brian.
Okay.
So for 2013, we basically had 56 fatalities in New York City.
Okay, and maybe I was looking at something, the wrong
thing.
It was
down from 76 the year before.
Okay.
We had about 17 of them in construction. Part of the decline over the year was due to a decline in retail trade. In 2012, we had 14 fatalities in retail trade, and many of these were holdups. People, retail clerks get shot on the job. People running liquor stores, bang.
Wow. Convenience stores.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about our fatalities is we have some data basically on ethnicity and race and demographic characteristics. Almost all the people who get killed on the job are male. Certainly almost all the construction workers who get killed on the job are male. We also track whether they're Hispanic or not, and it turns out that Hispanics account for a disproportionate share of the fatalities in New York City. In 2013, there were about 39% of the fatalities, and they have typically been overrepresented among construction laborers. And from 2012 to 2013, we had a drop in the number of fatalities, but we had the number of Hispanic fatalities is pretty much unchanged over the year. And nationally, the numbers of fatalities for almost all demographic groups improved from 2012 to 13, but not for Hispanics.
Huh. Because of the nature of the jobs that they are tending to take?
That's one possibility. I mean, one of the other interesting issues with Hispanics is that there really are different kinds of Hispanics, and we have, especially in New York City, we have a lot of immigrants, and the foreign-born Hispanics are less likely to speak English well. They're less likely to have a high school diploma. They're less likely to have health insurance.
If they're undocumented, then they're more likely to be put in risky situations without having any recourse?
You're asking me that, and that seems plausible. But you know, the whole thing with undocumented people is there's not a lot of documentation about
right
their situation.
But it's a question.
Yeah, and it's certainly plausible. And native-born Hispanics basically tend to do a better job of basically knowing English. They tend to be better educated, and there's a concern that a lot of the construction laborers basically are foreign-born Hispanics who don't have some of the choices and background that other people do.
Interesting that retail workers were getting killed in crime in these 2013 statistics. Do you know how many NYPD officers got killed in the line of duty in 2013?
In 2013,
I believe it was zero.
We did not publish a stat for fatalities in local governments.
I read that the assassinated officers, Ramos and Liu, last month, were the first New York City cops killed on the job since 2011. So zero in 2012, zero in 2013, zero in 2014 until the December 20th ambush.
Yeah.
So the public may overestimate the risk.
Well, it's not that they're overestimating. It's that many years can go by. But if you go back to 2001, you had lots and lots of Protective Service people who died.
In the World Trade Center attack.
Exactly.
All at once.
Yeah.
But you almost have to correct for that.
We have sort of two sets of historical numbers for New York City, with and without the numbers from 2001 for 9/11, because they are a big outlier.
Because it's such an unusual incident. But it's part of the risk of the job.
It
You're
going
to get killed in a terrorist attack and having to run toward the scene of a terrorist attack because it's your job.
Right. Those were work-related fatalities. And for the people in France who are working for Charlie Hebdo who were shot in their offices, those are work-related fatalities.
Absolutely. And still with us, the very patient Les Bowden, professor of public health at Boston University. So, Professor Bowden, there's often a mismatch between the risks we fear the most in life and the ones that are actually the most likely to do us in. I know that public health experts study that sort of thing. Are there certain factors that make us overestimate or underestimate risk in general?
Well, that's actually something that I'm not an expert in, but what I can tell you is that people don't really appreciate the impact on workers and their families of injuries that occur. And probably people who are in risky jobs don't want to think all the time about how risky their jobs are. So I think that both of those probably have an impact.
Did anything on that list, by the way, that top 10 mortality risk while at work, anything there surprise even you as a public health expert?
Not really, although I think that the risk is limited when we talk just about fatalities. You know, there are probably around 2,000 non-fatal injuries at work for every fatal injury. And, for example, something that got left off the list, which is actually quite dangerous work, is people who work in hospitals and nursing homes who have very high non-fatal injury risks, a lot of which has to do with having to move patients and
The risk of MRSA and other things that they can catch on the job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you have a separate list from the Bureau of Labor Statistics about injuries or disease?
We have a separate list of basically non-fatal occupations, and nursing assistants is number five. And they, as your professor was saying, do have a lot of strains, and they also get stuck with needles. At the top of that list, we have bus drivers. Police officers are second. Firefighters are third. Correctional officers are fourth.
Huh. So now you get into the uniformed services.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
And Professor Bowden, another way that you study risk, I gather, is the risk that our jobs or at-work lifestyles might kill us slowly. So it's one thing to fear dying in a fire as a firefighter or in a fall as a utility line worker, but something different to fear might be being a bus driver might eventually make us more susceptible to heart disease from a sedentary lifestyle or something like that. So are there data on jobs that take the most years off normal life for, you know, premature death expectancy by causing diseases over time rather than by getting killed instantly at work?
That's also a good question. I don't think there are actually good data about which jobs do that. There is some evidence that jobs that are stressful, and certainly, again, public protection kinds of jobs would fall in that category. Retail jobs might, if you've ever dealt with somebody who is unhappy about a purchase. So there are lots of jobs where there are pressures on people, and those pressures seem to affect cardiovascular risk. But it's also true that there is growing, although still young, evidence that having an injury at work that gets you out of work for at least 7 days can actually end up, possibly through the injury itself, possibly through the fact that people who have these injuries end up losing a huge amount of their lifetime earnings, that there's information that those people will die younger.
Listeners, do you have any favorite examples of your own of how we misperceive risk? A lot of people got items on that list right, who called in earlier. A lot of people got items on that list wrong. A lot of you listening who didn't think you were so expert in the topic, probably going, huh, really? Oh, that's number one? Oh, really? Oh, police officer isn't on the top 10 for and all of that. So what do you think? One of my favorites is the risk of flying somewhere on a big commercial airliner as a passenger versus driving. Airline travel is so safe compared to being behind the wheel, but we get white-knuckled on takeoff and landing. We don't when we're in our own risky driver's seats. I think that's partly because we feel in control when we drive. We feel out of control on an airplane. Another psychological factor for misperceiving risk is that a risk is imposed on us, you know, or that it might be spectacular and catastrophic. So nuclear power imposed on us and potentially catastrophic might make us more afraid than burning wood in your fireplace or in your wood stove every night. But which is statistically more likely to cause you harm in the United States? It's not even close. Professor Bowden, the EPA keeps statistics on that. And I guess public health policy needs to balance actual risks versus what people fear, huh?
I think that's right. So things that are in the news catch people's attention. They may not be the things that are actually the most risky, but when you see them, you react to them, and you think, oh, my gosh, this could happen to me. So I think maybe we were all surprised a little bit when we heard that there were no police fatalities for a couple of years, because we picture either because they're reported in the papers or because we see them on television that being a police officer maybe is riskier than it actually is. That's not to say that it's safe to be a police officer, of course.
And by the nature of it, you are going to confront danger. You're confronting people who want to commit violent crime. And so our next topic, and let me clear the board and get our phones going on this, is in fact going to be, if you are a police officer now or have ever been a police officer, or if you are the loved one of a police officer or a former police officer, call in and let's talk about those risks. Officers, how you cope with the risk on the job, how you manage the risk on the job, what risks are you willing to take in the name of public safety, and what risks are you not willing to take? That was part of the slowdown, but though this is not going to be a political segment about the slowdown, but part of the statement I think police officers were making with the slowdown over the last few weeks is we're not taking any risk if you people don't appreciate it, right? But let's talk about how you do manage risk under normal, in normal times, let's say, from a labor perspective, and let's talk about how you cope with it and how loved ones of police officers cope with it psychologically, knowing you're going to risk, you're going to work in this risky environment every day, even if it's not statistically risky, that that they're going to get killed on the job. We heard about Officer Wen Jin Lu calling his father in China every night on the way home from work. So I'm okay, Dad. And another one, we had a caller to the show last week who said he calls his cop son every day just to check in on them. So how do you manage this if you're a police officer or ever were a police officer or a loved one of a police officer? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, I want to thank my first guests, Martin Colley, Chief Regional Economist at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and Les Bowden, Professor of Public Health at Boston University. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.
You're welcome.
It's been really illuminating. On our family meeting about risk on The Brian Lehrer Show today, stay with us. It's a family meeting about risk on The Brian Lehrer Show today. And the two NYPD officers who were fatally shot in December marked the first time New York City police officers were killed in the line of duty since December 2011. While data shows New York City police officers face less risk of death than you may think, as we established in our previous segment, the perception of the many potential dangers they face and the many real dangers they do face affect the daily lives of police officers and their loved ones. And my next guest, Johnny Turno, knows all about these risks. After 21 years at the NYPD, he's now the Director of Graduate Studies in Criminal Justice at Molloy College and the publisher of several, the author of several books, including Policing Within the Law, a case study of the New York City Police Department. Welcome to WNYC, Mr. Turno.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And again, we're opening up the phones for police officers, former police officers, or any loved ones of police officers. How do you cope with the risks, the physical risk, the emotional stress of the risk in that line of work? 212-433-WNYC. The assassinations of officers Ramos and Liu, and then the two cops shot in the Bronx recently on a more routine crime call, make us very aware of the risks of being in law enforcement right now. How do you manage the risk for yourself, or how did you, if you're not in it anymore, or if you're a loved one of somebody who is or was in law enforcement? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let me start with a caller, Danny in Massapequa. Danny, thank you for calling in. You're on the air today.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to the guests. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with the other guests completely. My son is on a police department now. And people say to me, "Am I worried?" I said, "You're more of a chance of being killed on the way to work in a car accident than you are on duty." And the perception of people who aren't involved in law enforcement is that it's a very dangerous job, and it is a dangerous job. And the fact that other people die in or get injured in workplace accidents and not the victim of homicide will have people intentionally put a hatchet in the back of their head when they're not looking. But the real stress of the police department is not chasing down people with guns. I spent 20 years on patrol. That was the fun part. It's hard to believe. That's the nature of the person you're getting on the police department. They're looking for that adrenaline. They enjoy that. The part that wears cops down emotionally is the thousands of petty disputes you have to get in between over the course of a day with the family disputes and the car accidents and people yelling at each other over a food bill that was inappropriate. And that's the stress of being a police officer that wears down your soul after a while, because you're constantly seeing humanity at its worst and in a petty dispute, and you have to deal with it all. And the actual physical dangers, my dad was a police officer back in the 70s and 60s, and the reason the statistics are going down and making the job safer is one reason, bullet-resistant rest. My father was on the job back in the 60s and 70s where 50, 60 police officers a year would be shot and a dozen of them would die because they didn't have a bulletproof vest. So the reason it's less dangerous than it seems is because the two officers in the Bronx that day, they had vests on. I believe one of them was hit in the back, may have stopped by his vest. So you have plenty of officers who are alive today thanks to technology.
Yes.
It doesn't make the job any less stressful or violent to have someone shoot you just because you survived it, because of
right.
your vest.
Danny, thank you very much. So you're in a three-generation police officer family. Huh? Danny, thanks a lot. So how much of that resonates with you, Professor Turno?
Oh, a lot of it. And what he's talking about, especially PTSD over time, these are the types of things that happen again and again with police officers. It's not just that one incident, or it could be one incident. I mean, it does happen where you get PTSD from the one. But with many police officers, it happens over time. Suicide rates tend to be higher, alcoholism, domestic issues. Many of the officers, instead of turning for help, there's kind of this tough guy thing. And officers are less likely to turn for help than a typical person because they have this perception of themselves. Although there is help out there for them from the unions and other places on the job, but many officers won't take advantage of that. So over time, many of these things build up, causing officers to commit suicide, turn to alcoholism, domestic issues with their families. And I would add that officers feel they're caught in between many things. And I do think this demonstration that we've seen from the unions is an indication of how officers feel caught in between the political establishment. They feel caught in between the public's demands and demands from their family, and even and most importantly, demands from their bosses, which I find when I was on the job, that was very, very stressful. And I think for the last 12 years, it's been extremely stressful for officers. Quotas, having being told that you have to do a certain number of stop and frisks, and officers are doing what they're told. But it's stressful. And it's not only stressful in terms of doing the action. It's stressful because many officers, they don't want to do it. And they feel, well, gee, I'm not sure this is constitutional. I'm not sure this is right. So they're caught in between a huge number of forces that leads to a tremendous amount of stress on the street officer.
Ross in Port Washington, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ross. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to comment that in listening that when you rate risk, most of the danger is really through accidents. And it's really different for someone, especially a police officer, who is, can be the object of a person's aggression, where they're confronting an aggressive person, violent potentially in some way. And I think that's a really different kind of risk, which becomes, more psychological. You're just in real danger. You're the object of a threat.
Russ, thank you. Yeah, can you talk about that? Maybe it's a psychological analysis, Professor Eterno. But when we went through the list of the most dangerous jobs in America in terms of which ones you're actually most likely to die from at work instantly on a given day, logger, like lumberjack, was number one, and police officer wasn't even on the top 10 list. And yet the caller talks about the different nature of the job, where you don't think you're under attack when you're going to cut down a tree, but you know that you might be at any moment as a police officer.
That's correct, and that's certainly a part of it. We do have to understand that for police officers, they're dealing with people every single day. And I think I heard one of your people talking about people in retail having a high stress. Officers are dealing with regular individuals every day. But the problem is you can't determine. People know who you are. You're generally in uniform, standing out there. They know you're the cop. You're the good guy. But officers have to figure out, who's the bad guy and who's the good guy here? And you may just be going in to get a cup of coffee and not realize that the person standing right next to you could be wanted for murder. And you have to determine those things at a moment. These two officers who were assassinated, here they are. They're just sitting in their car, and unfortunately, and my heart goes out to their families, but they're just sitting there. They're really not anticipating any sort of reaction. A lumberjack, for example, he knows he's cutting down that tree, and he knows that there's an inherent danger in cutting down that tree, and it may be from, the saw or something that's immediately there that he can perceive. But for a police officer, you don't necessarily immediately perceive that danger. You got to it's kind of like walking into a movie in the middle of the movie and kind of trying to figure out what the heck happened earlier.
Yeah.
You got to,
the nature of the danger is different. I know they constantly train people who work with heavy machinery. I used to do voiceovers for one company's training films. And, people who work outside with heavy construction equipment are constantly getting trained on the dangers, the real risks of getting seriously injured or getting killed on the job. It's something that's got to be on their minds in those industries, but it's different. It's different than the stress of not knowing what's going to come around the corner at you at any second, or like you say, not knowing what kind of a threatening person you're standing next to in a convenience store, or when you get called on crime took place kind of call on your radio. This is not to minimize any of the other stresses or risks that we talked about in the previous segment. This is just to talk about how these things are qualitatively different in different lines of work. Bob in Oakland, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. You know what came to mind with respect to your topic is that...
And you're a retired cop, I understand?
That's correct. I'm a retired police lieutenant. I have 27 years on. And I worked in a fairly urbanized area. And there was a saying we always had. I'm sure a lot of people heard it. You know, the job is really like hours of boredom punctuated by moments of terror. And that's proportional to where you work, of course. But, you know, in the back of your mind, even in those hours of boredom, it's in the back of your mind that the potential is always there, you know, for a very violent confrontation that could injure you or even kill you. And I think, I mean, the way I used to deal with it, at least, was you almost have to detach from that in a certain way. Not that you drop your guard or you forget what you're doing in any way, but there has to be a certain detachment because, at least for me, again, to dwell on the potential for injury or even death, I mean, that's going to take somebody out of the picture. You couldn't complete a career if you just dwelled on that every moment of your day.
So you have to go into some kind of denial, or would you use a different word?
No, I think denial is a little too strong. I was always very aware. I mean, I tried to be very tactically keen on all the calls that I went on when I was in the street. But to dwell on that potential, I think, would be just completely damaging to a person.
Yeah.
I don't. They,
it would be psychologically.
I think that would be a very difficult thing to deal with.
Right.
If it's just your sole focus throughout the day.
Were you ever in a situation where you had to make a split-second decision about how much risk to put yourself in to accomplish something?
Yeah, I probably more often than I could count. You know, again, I worked in a pretty urbanized area. I was involved in a shooting. There were several incidents like that. And, it's not infrequent. Let's put it that way.
Can you give me an example, and maybe an example where, and you said you were a lieutenant, that maybe there was you know, you were on the decision-making bubble about something, either with respect to yourself or what you were ordering people into, where maybe it's a fluid situation and you think, well, I want to catch this guy or I want to do that, but I don't know how much this risk this is to me or to my officers. Can you think of an instance in how you manage that risk, how you make those decisions?
You know, it's very fluid, of course, and each decision is very unique in the way you approach it. But what comes to mind is active shooter situations. And depending on the environment in which it's taking place, you know, the risk is going to be in flux as to where do you put your officers or even yourself, and how much risk you're willing to accept. And it's I don't know if there's any book to really help you with making those decisions. It's very fluid. And you always have to be very cognizant, I think, of the potential dangers. And certainly, as the one I cited, the active shooter situation is probably one of the more serious things I can think of. You're certainly tuned into the potential danger of that, which is very high, as opposed to maybe going on a burglary call where the perceived danger may not be as high, and it almost rolls you into a false sense of security, and then you get injured on that one. So it's such a fluid situation, with each incident being very individualized.
Bob,
it's a hard call to make.
Thank you very much for your call. And Professor Eterno, based on your 21 years in the NYPD, how would you answer that same question? And can you think of any either stories that come to mind from your career or principles of managing risk in fluid situations?
Sure. It's very different being a boss and being a police officer. It changes. As a boss, you're now required to figure out what to do with all the officers and how you're going to handle that situation. I can recall many situations dealing with emotionally disturbed people, dealing with people with guns, for example. I can recall one incident in Chelsea where I was driving with my partner. I saw a man with a gun on the coming out of a bar. I told my partner, there's a man with a gun over there. He looks at me and he goes, you got to be kidding. And sure enough, he was there. I said, no, stop the car. And he stops the car. And when he stopped it, I was directly faced with him. He stopped the car in a way. When I opened the door, the perpetrator was standing right before me. So he's standing there with a gun. There's a lot of people behind him. And I had to make that decision whether or not to shoot him in a matter of seconds. I didn't shoot him. I ran up to him and I pulled the gun out of his hand and threw him down on the ground. But, you know, different people are going to take different steps. I would point out, though, that the training at the New York City Police Department is amongst the best in the world. And the training kicks in those moments. You're not thinking about the danger at that moment. You're thinking about how you were trained, what to do in that situation, and it kicks right in. It's almost automatic. That's how good that training is at NYPD, and I want to commend them for the training that I received. And also, I think you know, your brother and sister officers who are there with you, helping you. You know you're not out there alone, and that is helpful. And I wanted to point out one other thing that occurred to me, and this is while I was in the police academy. We were in the gym, and you're going out to the locker room, we're getting changed, and the guy next to me says, you know, I'm not so worried about dying. He's more worried about, he says, I'm more worried about becoming a paraplegic or something, or becoming a burden on my family and things like that. So my point is that these types of thoughts do run through officers' mind. They are there. But when the incident happens, when something happens, your training kicks in and you act the way you were trained. And I would say this to any officer throughout the United States, that training is important, critical, and in fact, the more training we can get, the better. And I am very, very adamant about that. We saw the officers in France. Their SWAT teams working. I mean, very, very professional teams working out there. But
and it works the other way, too, when not to fire, because we have all these incidents of unarmed or innocent people getting killed, which, of course, you know, make the news and become big sources of protest. And these are things that happen usually in split-second, fluid, fast-moving, you know, situations. Going to take Eric Garner out of it because I actually think it's another category, but Ferguson, yeah. For example.
No, absolutely. Where somebody comes at you, what do you do? This guy went into the car after the officer. So, I mean, your training is very critical, and I think it's something that we need to you know, focus on as a democratic society and understand that police officers are only human beings. We need to get that image from TV out of your head. When I taught out of the police academy, when I was teaching at the New York City Police Academy, first thing I would say to the recruits is, please, you know, get away from that image that you're a Superman or anything like that. You're a human being, and those things that happen on TV are just false. And I hope the public understands that they're just human. All of us are just human. We have families and friends and kids and you know, sometimes people just see blue. I can remember people calling me a pig in the street, spitting at me, and they didn't know who I was. They were clueless. All they saw was the uniform. And that's the type of thing that officers deal with and I dealt with every single day. It was something that was very difficult, very difficult. And when people treat you in that manner, not understanding that you're out there protecting their basic rights, protecting their freedoms, and also protecting them from the bad guys, it is very discouraging.
John Eterno, criminal justice professor at Molloy College, 21 years on the NYPD, and the author of several books, including Policing Within the Law, a case study of the New York City Police Department. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show. on WNYC. And lucky or unlucky, it's our family meeting about risk today. Coming up, how society is trying to make childhood more risk-proof than when you were a kid. Are we going too far? Or is the backlash the stupidest thing you've ever heard? Why do some people today glorify risks, equate the risk of your kid getting hurt with some notion of freedom? We will talk about that. And Alex Blumberg from the podcast Startup talks about risking it all for fame and fortune, and he'll compare notes with you on the risks that you have taken with your money, used to be with Planet Money. But right now, let's do some call-ins. First, a call-in for immigrants. What risks did you take in coming to the United States to live? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Immigrants only for the next few minutes. A call-in for immigrants. What risks did you take in coming to the United States to live? Immigrants, it's a chance to tell this part of your story. 212-433-9692. I ask because this is a defining feature of being an American. As a nation of immigrants, we are a nation of risk takers. It's an essential American characteristic. Risk-averse people do not cross the Atlantic as explorers. Risk-averse people do not leave England or Amsterdam for the New World in the 17th century. Risk-averse people do not try to scurry across the U.S.-Mexico border today. The risk-averse stay home. So almost by definition, as a nation of immigrants, we are a nation of risk takers. And of course, refugees and some others come out of sheer desperation. And some of you are descendants of slaves, obviously, who did not take any kind of action by choice to come here or have your families come here. But for so many American families, you are here because you or your ancestors were the ones who were adventurous enough, comfortable enough with risk to be the immigrants while others stayed home, the risk-averse stay home. So immigrants, tell us your stories. What risks did you take? What risk-benefit analysis did you do before deciding, I'm going to pack it up and go to the United States because I can? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, our family meeting about risk. This also affects our politics, by the way. That's a big reason, I believe, why the U.S. is less welfare-friendly than our European counterparts. There is something in our heritage that says risk is just normal, that you triumph over risk through work and character compared to the European mindset based on hundreds of years and a few thousand years of history where the risk of the individual did not, could not, produce rewards as often as in this country, at least at times in our country's history. So immigrants, tell us your stories. What risks did you take? What risk-benefit analysis did you make before coming to the United States? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's start with Stephen in Tuckahoe. Stephen, you're on WNYC. Hello there.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Where'd you come from?
Well, I come from Romania, former communist Romania.
Uh-huh.
And basically, it's like when I was 16, I crossed the border into Yugoslavia and then like crossed the border illegally into Austria. And then I spent some time in jail for illegal border crossing and ended up in Treichskirchen, which was a refugee camp. And I had to stay for about 4 months. I got investigated. I had to go through health checks and all the stuff that, you know, what refugees go through, legal refugees. I ended up in the States.
Did you have a sense of what you might have been getting yourself into when you left Romania?
Well, I was 16. You know what? A sense of adventure was there. And also, you know what? I wanted to escape that system that was so oppressive. I had bouts with the Secret Service. I got beaten up because they found out that I wanted to actually escape in the past. So when that happens to you, you kind of think, well, I have to do something better for myself.
Why do you think you were willing to take those risks and others who are living under the same system in Romania were not?
Well, a lot of them have. In my small little towns, like of 300-400 citizens, like, you know, basically a lot of young people have left. We're all over the world.
Sure, once you could, right? But, I mean, when it was really risky, like in this, in your case, with the things that you faced, probably you and a few of your peers took off, and a lot of your 16-year-old peers at that time weren't going to chance it.
You know what it is? It's the person. If you have it in you and you have this vision, and let me tell you, the West was always... you know, it gave you that freedom, idea of being free and actually making your own choices, which you didn't have back in the old communist Romania. So basically, it's like, you know what, you can say that some have it and some don't. It's the individual that is willing to take the risk and go that far to actually achieve, like, you know, the freedom that he seeks.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you. Yoli in Westfield, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hello, Yoli.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Where'd you come from?
I came from Colombia.
And what risks? Did you do a risk-benefit analysis, kind of, before you came?
Well, I was 21, so I figured out that that the United States was the place for me to... learn English and start my life. My country was, at that time, a lot of violence was going on, and I just want to change, and I took a risk.
What risk did you feel you were taking? You mentioned something that you were escaping, which is that your country was violent at that time. Did you have a sense of what you were risking?
Yes. I knew that I was going to sacrifice missing my family more than anything else. My family more than anything else.
Yeah.
So
why do you think you, Yoli, and probably some other people you knew when you were 21, and not a lot of other people?
What the reason why I took a risk and others they don't?
Yes.
I think it's God. It's just, I guess when I look back, I say, I sometimes think, and my kids question me, how you made it, how you made that decision. So I just don't know. I just went with it and took a risk. It was very, the first years, it was really hard. The language and missing my family was horrible for me. But, you know, we get used to it. We start to merge into different lifestyle, and that was it.
Yoli, thank you very much. And
thank you.
Continued
Thanks.
Good luck. Mayor Marie in Whitestone, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi, how are you? I'm doing great. I just wanted to let you know that I was 4 years old when my mother and father took the risk. They were in their 30s to emigrate from Ireland. And the reason why they did it was there was no work there at that point in time. And it was probably, I often reflect on my life and I think, well, what my life would have been. And I went through the New York City public school systems, the New York City educational system, and I now have a doctoral degree in nursing. And it was probably one of the most riskiest things my parents could have done then. But I believe that had they not done that, I don't think I ever would have been where I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely was worth the risk.
And it's certainly, you know, something to look back and say, wow, things are so much better here than they would have been if my parents had stayed over there, wherever over there is. But what about the risks that they were taking? So you told me what they were fleeing. It wasn't a good economic time in Ireland. Did they have a sense of the risk? You said they took huge risks. What were the if they were leaving a bad situation, what were the risks of coming here?
Well, the risks of coming here were they had no social support. It was my parents. My father's brother was here, but everyone else. My mother had three small children. Her sister and all of her siblings were in Ireland, so that social support wasn't there. She had a very thick Irish brogue. Even though she spoke English, it was difficult for people to understand her. She had an education up to the age of 14, so she really wasn't. She didn't have a lot of job opportunities, but they took that risk because they knew they wanted a better life for their family.
Why your parents and not some of the other people, as I'm asking all the callers? Do you think there was something that made them more risk tolerant than some of their neighbors who didn't leave Ireland at the time?
I think that's a really good question, because my father and my mother both had siblings there that did not make that decision to come to the United States, and they were living in conditions that were poverty at that time. I really don't know why. I just believe that my father was the type of person that he had this innate feeling that he wanted to do better. And just like your first caller from Romania, he had said something about that, just knowing that you wanted to. Sometimes I say go with your gut. Even though you have the intelligence, go with your gut and let that take you where you want to be.
Thank you very much for calling. Continued good luck. Yusuf in Newark, you're on WNYC. Hello, Yusuf.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. Where'd you come from?
I'm coming from Togo.
And, yes.
Okay.
And
yeah, I mean.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead. No, you go.
Yeah, Brian, what I would say, first of all, you said what would make us take a risk. First of all, before I even leave Togo, I didn't even consider us taking it as a risk. Because when I made my mind to leave Togo, I've taught myself that regardless of what I'm going to have to face in this country, it won't be like it will be nothing compared to what I faced there in Togo. Even though Togo, we never knew any major violence. However, life there is a struggle. So, and I knew that when I came once in the U.S., regardless of how tough things will be, I will be able. Like I feel like I'm
right.
ready to face
so it.
So
it didn't feel like a risk for you. It just felt like an opportunity.
That's true. It didn't feel like a risk.
And was that the experience you actually had once you got here?
No. When I came here, it was a lot of difficulties, and I'm still going through the same difficulties right now. I have three kids here. I drive taxi full-time, and I go to school full-time. I'm a third-year civil engineering. So I still don't have a life on my own, and I keep taking those risks, hoping the best.
And I hope the best for you. And if you're getting an engineering degree, things are probably going to turn out okay, at least on the job front. Yusuf, good luck. Thank you. Jadish in Hicksville.
Good morning, Brian.
Hi, Jadish.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Where'd you come from?
Afghanistan.
And?
And I was there. I crossed one border from Afghanistan to Pakistan. And the agent put me in the plane without passport to get to America. So 31 years ago, easy. That was very easy, the agent, to put you in the plane without passport. They give you boarding pass, and you get here. You get here, you show up your... you can say I'm from Afghanistan, so that's the way it was that, 31 years ago.
31 years ago, so before the current Afghanistan war. What were you escaping? What were you trying to get away from?
You know, population was Muslim, 99.9%, so I'm the Hindu, less than 1%. So all Hindu was leaving. If you don't leave, they're going to put you in the army for 2 years. So you have to finish the army, you know. Or it's very tough for us to do army. You know, that time was you fight with the Mujahideen was that time was in Afghanistan. So you know, the Hindu boy was leaving because otherwise they go in the army. So there was no other choice.
And the question that I'm asking everybody: why you? Unless all your friends did it at that time. Why do you think you were willing to go through all the risk and the story that you were telling before, and probably a lot of your Hindu friends stayed home, yes?
No, all of them, the Hindus, the boys, like 17, 18, or 20 years old boys, they left because this is very poor family I have.
Yes.
If I don't leave, the family
can't leave either. It took me 6 months to get here. From when I left my home, July 1983, I got here in 1984 in February. So it took me 6 months. When I got here, say to my family, I got here. Then they left Afghanistan. They went to India. So that's the you can't support the family. You can't leave all in one time. Till you know, if the family is very poor.
Yes, Jardish, I'm glad you made it, and thanks for calling. Lisa in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, I'm calling. We're originally from Haiti. And my mom came here first. She came here in 1965. She had to leave me behind and my dad behind. And what was happening back then is you had a lot of women, white women, like Jewish women from Scarsdale. They were coming to Haiti. They were getting these women who were working at hotels and with the promise that if they came with them to work as housekeepers and take care of their kids, that they would eventually give them their green cards because they could sponsor them.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom took that risk. She came here. She left me behind. She left me at a boarding school in Haiti, and she came to this country. Some women did get their green cards. Other women, they ended up with families who it didn't work out. You know, they ended up leaving the homes and didn't have a green card after the fact, or they didn't get paid that much money.
Was your mom aware of that risk when she came?
Oh, absolutely, but it was a better chance. They were in Haiti at the time of the Duvalier regime, and she didn't come from a wealthy family and wanted a better way of life. So instead of working in hotels and service-oriented jobs there where you weren't making that much money, she figured if she came here that she could give me a better, and at that time it was just me, so she could give me a better life.
Why do you think she took that risk? And what an emotionally wrenching thing it must be to leave your four-year-old child behind in one country while you go to an unknown circumstance in another country. Why do you think your mother was that risk tolerant, and maybe some of her friends in similar situations were not?
Well, I'd say, you know, like some people, I look at her family members, she was the one who was more of a risk taker. She was the youngest of nine kids. And I think because she was the youngest, she may have gotten, when she was smaller, some opportunities that her other siblings didn't get, was a little more exposed to what was out there, and said that she wanted to go out there and work. And that meant that she was put to work early. When I said she got more opportunities. She didn't get much of an education, but she felt that she could go out there even further, get a better way of life. She took care of the rest of the family. She was always sending money home to take care of her mom, her siblings, mm-hmm. like where most of them, they came after, but they came much later. She was the one doing it. So she had that personality, plus because she was a little younger, I think she was kind of sent out a little earlier than the other ones
yeah.
who were helping out at home.
So it's amazing, Lisa, isn't it? We are a nation of risk takers from Haiti, from Ireland, from Afghanistan. Unbelievable, huh?
Totally.
Thank you very much. Immigrants, thank you. That was an amazing call. It's our family meeting about risk on the Brian Lehrer Show today. Let's do another call in, a quickie, before we get to that conversation that I mentioned earlier about trying to take all the risk out of childhood these days. Which is worse, too much security in childhood, or is the backlash to child safety the weirdest, most illogical, reactionary piece of false nostalgia? That's not now. That's in a few minutes. Right now, just call in with the riskiest thing you do in your life. 212-433-WNYC. I think we're going to have to clear the board of more immigrants who are calling in, not quite realizing that segment is over, because I want to get all the lines clear, because we're going to go through people really fast on this just for a few minutes. 212-433-WNYC to just share in a few words, what is the riskiest thing you currently do on a regular basis in your own life? What is the riskiest thing you do in your life? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What am I thinking of? Well, maybe it's having an affair or otherwise taking risks with your relationship or your reputation. You know, like an Anthony Weiner kind of risk. Anyone doing anything like that? 212-433-WNYC. Just call in with the riskiest thing you do in your life, in any category of your life. Maybe it's riding a motorcycle. Maybe it's eating a pint of ice cream every day. Maybe it's skydiving on the weekends because you're a thrill seeker for fun. Just call in with the riskiest thing you do in your life. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Don't overthink this one. Let's just share in a few words. What is the riskiest thing you do currently on a regular basis in your own life? 212-433-9692. We'll just do this for a few minutes, so call right now. You'll get right on and right off. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. What is the riskiest thing you currently do on a regular basis in your own life? And Yeska in Long Island City, you're on WNYC. What's the riskiest thing you do?
The riskiest thing I do or I did is decided to have a baby, and I take care of him every day. Oh. I had quite a comfortable life, decent income, lots of travel, lots of friends, exciting hobbies. And my husband and I decided to take the plunge and have a child. And it was a huge decision that really changed our lives. And
when you talk about having lots of hobbies and stuff, was it the risk of feeling tethered?
I knew it would be a huge, it would make a huge impact on our time, on our resources. And before making that decision, we had lots of talks and should we not? And we decided, let's finally do it. But it really felt like taking a big jump or something like that off a building, or just a huge, huge risk for us.
Thank you very much. And I hope it works out. Francesca in Seattle, you're on WNYC. What risk do you take in your life?
Hi, Brian. So I was going to say that going to school, that is super expensive and taking a lot of loans to do so, I think is the one risk that a lot of people are taking.
So you're doing that, taking out a lot of student loans, and you're thinking, oh, my goodness, this is not just investing in my future. This is a risk.
Yeah, and I cannot tell you that sometimes, you know, you wonder, is this going to work? Is this going to work? You can only go by what you read, your research and everything, but there is no assurance. And I guess, you know, that's what kills a lot of students nowadays, you know.
Francesca.
But you do it because you want to be better.
Thank you very much. Judy in Brooklyn, what's the risk you're taking in your life? Hi, Judy. Judy, is that a Judy
Hello?
In Brooklyn? Hi, Judy.
Hi. I think the riskiest thing I do is have sex without condom while I'm casually dating.
Why do you do that?
Well, there's a point where, like, you start to like someone, and then maybe you do that, and then maybe things don't work out.
Yeah, so you're conflicted about that one, right?
Yeah, I mean, other than that, I'm pretty boring, so.
Okay, so that's very candid. Judy, use a condom. Anne in Eatontown, what's the riskiest thing you're doing? Hi.
Hello?
Hi, tell me about your risk.
Hi, my husband and I sued the FBI.
Really, the FBI? What'd you sue them for, can you say?
We learned that they had been maintaining false data about him in their files, and it was being disseminated. They disseminated it to the banks, to friends and family, to employees and landlords, and it completely upended our personal lives, our financial lives, our reputations.
Wow.
Destroyed.
So what's the risk in suing? Is there a downside risk in filing this suit?
There was for my husband. They pursued a grand jury investigation, and they manufactured false evidence, and he was indicted, and he was sent to prison, and he spent 7 years there. And when he sued the FBI from there, he was sent on what is called a BOP tour. He was sent to different higher security prisons.
And thank you very much. You can tweet at us, too, folks. What's the riskiest thing you do currently in your life. Raul tweeted, crossing the street is the riskiest thing I do daily. He's been reading those Vision Zero stats. Danielle tweeted, biking on the city streets, staying in the bike lane doesn't help. Dan in Bushwick, you're on that same page?
Yeah, hi, Brian. I was just going to say, riding my bike in Brooklyn, I say my prayers and, you know, strap on my helmet and do my best, but I get grief from the police. There's drunk motorists everywhere. So, you know, I just think we need to support our cyclists.
Thank you very much. Kai in New Jersey, what's the risk you take?
The risk I take is I fly aerobatic gliders.
Aerobatic gliders.
Are those airplanes without engines?
Yeah, I know. Gliders. Yeah.
And then you release, and then you do what you want to do. Loops, rolls, hammerheads.
Is it risky?
Not if you're following all the rules, but I guess people would consider it risky. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Shane in Colonia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shane. What's the riskiest thing you do in your life?
I don't have the glider guy beat, but I'm a scuba instructor myself. So teaching students how to dive in a quarry in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that's pretty much my day-to-day.
Thank you very much. And Mark in Washington Township, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing? What I do, which is risky, but it's a lot of fun, is I race motorcycles in my spare time.
Is it just the thrill?
Yeah, just the thrill, the speed, and I don't do the drag racing. I do the slalom track. So when you get down real far and your knees are on the ground, it's a lot of fun.
How do you deal with the risk?
I don't really, because to me the adrenaline and the rush outweighs the risk. It's just the risk isn't. I mean, it's definitely risky. It's scary, but it's just too much fun.
Daryl in Red Hook, what's the biggest risk you take? Daryl in Red Hook, what's your risk?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's Daryl in Brooklyn.
Oh, hi. Yeah.
Hey, the biggest risk I take is I try to provide my family as a freelancer in film production. There's no steady paycheck.
As a freelancer in production. Yes. Abdu in Manhattan, what risk are you calling about?
Driving a yellow cab. And mostly working 7 days. I wake up in the morning like 4 o'clock, and then I finish by 4 o'clock. Well, you know, like the risk is very high, you know, getting killed by other cabs or, you know, by in the middle of traffic, you know, like every day that I wake up, it occurs to me, you know, one day I will get seriously injured. You know, that's it. It's a very risky job. But it's a fun job. I listen to you guys, WNYC, all day long. I just wanted to share that with you guys.
Okay, thank you. Richard on Staten Island, last one. What's your risk?
I bait police officers. I regularly get drunk and bait police officers.
That's not smart.
Well, it's not. Someone's got to do it.
Why do you do it?
Some matters.
What do you do? What? Do you do it for a reason?
I don't like, I have a chip on my shoulder and I have an authority complex. But more than that, I don't like. Let's put it this way. If I was African-American, I'd probably be dead because they don't like to be spoken to in certain ways. They don't like to be questioned. They always have to be right.
Richard, thank you very much. Well, that was some way to end. I get drunk and bait police officers, Richard on Staten Island. So thanks for calling in. Now we have a little potpourri, grab bag of the risks that Brian Lehrer Show listeners take in your lives. It's our family meeting on risks today. Coming up next, we'll talk about trying to take all the risk of out of childhood these days. Which is worse? Too much security in childhood, taking out some of the pleasure, taking out some of the development, perhaps, that comes with risk? Or is the backlash to child safety the weirdest, most illogical piece of false nostalgia imaginable? That's coming up next, the Brian Lehrer Show Family Meeting on Risk.
Here I go again. I hear those trumpets blow again, all aglow again, taking a chance on love. Here I slide again, about to take that ride again, starry-eyed again, taking a chance on love.
Rock.
Rock-a-bye baby on the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. And down will come baby, cradle and all.
All right. Is your first reaction to hearing that lullaby? Call Child Protective Services. Somebody put their baby in a treetop. I don't know that anyone ever really did that with an infant, but I think we'd all agree that our tolerance for risk when it comes to our kids is narrowing. As we continue with our family meeting on risk, I'm joined by Amy Fusselman, whose book is Savage Park, A Meditation on Play, Space, and Risk for Americans Who Are Nervous, Distracted, and Afraid to Die. It is out today from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Welcome to WNYC, Amy Fusselman.
Thank you so much for having me.
I get the sense that you had an aha moment at this park in Japan you visited with your sons, and you came to question how, as particularly middle-class Americans, we seem to be missing the forest for the trees when it comes to childhood play and risk. And there were literally children in the trees in that park from looking at your book. So start by telling us about this so-called Savage Park of your title.
Yes. Savage Park is the name of the Hanagi Play Park in Japan. It's the name that my host's son affectionately called the play park. And when she first took me to the park, it was really one of those moments where seeing it felt like a confrontation, in the sense that its mere existence made me rethink every play space that I knew as a New York City parent. It completely upended my notion of what is possible.
You saw open fires?
Yes, yes. The children at the park are encouraged to play with the four elements of which, you know, fire is one.
Saws?
Yes. Tools are available for all the children to use in the play park and adults as well.
Heavily supervised?
Not so much. I mean, that's really the most provocative thing about this play park, which is an adventure playground. And for those of you who don't know, adventure playgrounds were first begun by landscape architect Carl Sorensen in 1943 in Copenhagen, when that town was under German occupation. And they consist of, you know, a vacant lot, donated tools, and a play worker who's there to facilitate the children's play, but not to direct it. Critical, not to direct it.
And you saw tree climbing, which, by the way, is illegal in Central Park, I think.
It is against park rules, yes.
And what are kids in New York missing, in your opinion, by not being allowed to climb trees in Central Park, for example?
Well, I think the first thing that I came back and wanted to start looking at was, what do we think play is, that we construct spaces that are so impoverished? And, you know, what play is a really knotty and complicated question. I mean, the Brian Sutton Smith, the play scholar, has written about how the idea of play as a progress, a kind of rehearsal for something that children will do later in life, is so dominant that it's really blotted out all other understandings. And it kind of, because it's this notion of a progress that needs to be supervised and curated by adults.
So is this about risk? Is this about trying to take the physical risks out of childhood too much?
Well, I think that there's a lot of fear about what play is and the unruliness of it. I mean, Sutton Smith also addresses the notion that parents would rather play sports, really, than fantasy games with their child, because sports have rules. I mean, I think it really it confronts us with aspects of our children that are uncomfortable. And the way that we kind of shut down playgrounds, in the sense that we make them, you know, very difficult to manipulate, they're environments that can't be changed, they're often not connected to local space in any way, it's part of it.
Listeners, are there risks you took as a child that you won't consider for your own children now? 212-433-WNYC. Do you have a story to share about risk and reward for your children, or that you experienced as a child? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. For Amy Fusselman, author of the new book Savage Park, A Meditation on Play, Space, and Risk for Americans Who Are Nervous, Distracted, and Afraid to Die. That's a lot to put on a book jacket. You think this risk aversion is a particular problem for Americans?
Well, I do think that our culture of litigation makes it particularly naughty. I mean, there's no way, unlike the Hanegy Play Park, there's no way that a sign saying play freely at your own risk, you know, is going to fly in the United States. I mean, the Adventure Playground in Berkeley, California, which, you know, was begun around the same time as Hanegy Play Park, I visited this summer, and in fact, you know, you do sign a waiver before your child and you enter the park.
And is it of this time? I mean, we talked about risky jobs earlier in the show when most work was dangerous and infant mortality was high. Were parents more aware of the need for risk and play or just unable to prevent it?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, there's a moment in the book where I was trying to look for a device for my daughter called a baby bath ring, and I had found that in the time between the birth of my second and third child, this product had been changed so that a plastic arm was affixed from the bath ring to the side of the tub. It was like a huge prosthetic arm had been put on this object in order to keep it more safe. I do think that, you know, there's an increase in really what we're willing to do, the lengths we're willing to go to, quote, make our children safe.
Ben in Garwood, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Brian. Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Thanks. So I have a little story. I was in Berlin, Germany, a couple of years back with my then 2-year-old daughter. Now she's 4. And Berlin has some of the world's great playgrounds, just incredible towers, 30, 40 feet high. And there are no signs that say, this is the big kid playground, this is the little kid playground. And we experienced toddlers playing, including my 2-year-old, playing along with big kids, 8, 10 years old, which was delightful for her. I enjoyed it. And then when we got back to the city, the neighborhood playgrounds that are 5 feet off the ground seemed rink-a-dink by comparison. And I actually met a parent there who I was chatting with. And he laughed about this. He said, you know, you Americans, you have regulated all of the fun out of your playgrounds because you don't want lawsuits, but you let people die in traffic all the time, which I thought was a perfect commentary.
Yes, yes. I mean, that really speaks to it. What we miss, I mean, that's really what I hope people take away from my book, is to ask the question, what are we missing in making these playgrounds the way they are? What are we really keeping children from?
There is a part of me that wants to push back and say, wait a minute, which is worse again, too much security in childhood or the backlash to child safety? We want child safety, right? We don't want whatever statistics we can prevent of kids falling off high monkey bars onto concrete or whatever. Maybe that's a fake one, I don't know. But whatever one we want to name, that was actually hurting kids or killing kids.
Of course. I mean, the bottom line is the loss of any child is a tragedy beyond anything. And that's, you know, what drives it. That fear, the fear that you gain, that is born when you become a parent. You know, there's no escaping that.
But can we have it both ways? Or do we have to live with more actual physical peril to our children, the most precious things in our lives, and plus they're, you know, autonomous human beings who we are bound to protect, in order to give them these experiences in childhood?
Right. Well, one thing, you know, in writing the book was that I was exposed to the notion of play in more of a Hindu culture where the world is at play. A human is in some ways being played all the time in the world. Our Western notion of play is more heroic and individual. We play in playgrounds. So maybe there's something between the two, between East and West, a kind of, can we accept that we are both at play and playing?
Julie in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Oh, hi. I'm one of these people who thinks it's quite a myth that there used to be a period in American culture where children walked home from school independently and played outside independently in unsupervised groups and were exposed to all sorts of risks and ended up unscathed. I had very laissez-faire parents who were probably the norm for the 50s and the 60s, and I was molested twice. I actually managed to go blind while playing with a chemistry set and exploded some lye.
Wow.
I think you can expose children to intellectual risks and there can be risks even taken in character building. But I think this myth that there was a past in American culture where children just went about their business and emerged unscathed is simply not true. I wish it were true, but I don't think it is.
Julie, do they still make that kind of chemistry set?
Well, interestingly enough, no. And in fact, you know, these little balls of soap that you could put in the tub and they make soapy water, there's actually now a warning label on them that they do contain lye, and you have to be careful with them.
There you go. Julie, thank you. Thank you for your call. Well, what a story. And that's the other side of, you know, what can happen.
Right. I'm sorry to hear for her experience. You know, I was sexually abused as a kid as well, and I have a book about it. I don't know. That's a trickier subject and something that I'm not sure is completely related to the environment.
Tom in Hastings, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay.
Well, I grew up in Queens, and I don't know, we were about 8 or 9 at the time, and we discovered that New York City was just a marvelous playground. And we used to sneak on the trains all the time. And one day we got into Manhattan, and we were robbed as soon as we got off the train. And all our money was taken. But we got into the stairwells, the Empire State Building. That's where we were headed. And we ran all the way up to the top, got into another stairwell, and got into another room with a ladder. And we got up on top, opened the hatch, and we could have climbed inside the tower, except we got too frightened from the wind. And me and my friend, we backed off, closed the hatch, and went down. And we did other risky things like that, and we survived. But I, too, we lived across a street from the 39 World's Fair, and that was just an amazing playground as well. Because a lot of the old buildings and structures were up, and so we just had an amazing experience as children growing up in Queens.
And taking some risks.
Yes.
Like outside the Empire State Building. Didn't you, Amy, do some wire walking with Philippe Petit, who gained fame as the guy who walked between the Twin Towers in 1974?
Yes, I did. I took a wire walking class with him. It was an amazing experience.
Do adults need to have some more risky play too then?
I agree. I think that the notion that play is only for children and something that they, you know, outgrow on their way to becoming, oh, let's say, members of the flexible workforce is something that we should, you know, would be good to reexamine. Adults do play.
Let's see, I think Mayor Bloomberg was for risk in playgrounds. Do you remember that summer when parents were complaining about the dangers of burns from the black safety mats in the city playground?
Mm-hmm.
And the mayor said,
if it's hot, don't sit on it.
So how far do you want to take this? Should the government assume all parents are paying attention?
Well, I think that's you put your finger on exactly the thing, is are we paying attention and how are we paying attention? I think that's really the critical question.
So I don't know your parent status.
I have 3 kids.
Do you allow them to take risks now that maybe you didn't before thinking about all this?
Well, I think, you know, one of the nice things about the book is that it's not about, you know, heroics. I came back from this extraordinary space with my kids, and yes, we were in our New York City apartment, and there's no possible way to recreate, you know, an adventure playground in an apartment.
Right. And of course, you're a parent. You started by talking about this experience with your kids in Japan.
Right.
And so we will leave it there in our family meeting on risk with Amy Fusselman. Her new book is Savage Park, A Meditation on Play, Space, and Risk for Americans Who Are Nervous, Distracted, and Afraid to Die. She also writes the Family Practice Parenting column for McSweeney's Internet Tendency. You're Dr. Amy Fusselman.
I'm a faux doctor,
A faux doctor in that online world. And listeners, if you're intrigued by this and want to meet Amy Fusselman in person, she will be reading tomorrow at the Powerhouse on 8th.
On 8th Avenue, yes.
Powerhouse on 8th Avenue.
In Park Slope.
In Park Slope at 6:30 p.m. That's tomorrow, Wednesday the 14th. Thank you for joining us in our family meeting on risk.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
But I won't go. I can't do it on my own.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's our family meeting on risk today. And in some jobs, as we were discussing earlier, you risk life and limb. But when you start your own business, you might risk your credit score, your savings, and, well, your sanity. My next guest is one of those people who has now gone out on his own, and he's documenting the risks that he is taking and the risks his investors are taking in a new podcast called Startup. He's Alex Blumberg, now the CEO of Gimlet Media and host of the Startup Podcast, formerly of Planet Money and This American Life. Maybe many of you know him from that if you're not already startup listeners. Hey, Alex, welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here. Thanks, Brian.
And listeners, if you started your own business or struck out on your own to freelance, how did you calculate the personal and financial risk you'd be taking? Give us a call and compare notes with Alec Blumberg. And if you're listening to the Startup Podcast, maybe you'll have a question based on that that might even relate to your own entrepreneurial risk. 212-433-WNYC-433-9692. And Alex, as you point out, on Startup, only about one-third of new businesses make it to the 10-year mark. Did you have that in the back of your mind, raising your blood pressure when you decided to do what you're doing?
Oh, it's not in the back of my mind. It's very much in the forefront of my mind. It's something that you can't help but think about all the time when you're doing this.
So what drove you? Why did you make the jump from a stable job with benefits? I guess we can call being Planet Money's Alex Blumberg that, to strike out on your own with Startup.
I don't really have a good answer. It was partly I felt like I was pulled into it. It was the opportunity that I felt I saw. It seemed so compelling, and it was really like I really was thinking like somebody should do this. Somebody should do this, and nobody was doing it really the way I thought it should be done. And then finally, I'd been thinking about it for so long, and it felt like I had to try. It wasn't that I was frustrated with my old job or that I was like, you know, I was like, I'd had enough or I was bored. It was really like, It just felt like there was it. I mean, it really did. It felt like there was this thing that I felt I saw, an opportunity that I felt I saw that I needed to pursue. And if I didn't, I would have just always wondered about it.
You have two kids. You talk about that sometimes.
Yes.
Does being a parent make you more risk tolerant or more risk averse or none of the above?
I mean, you know, we should put the risk in perspective, especially when you're, you know, I think it makes you less risk tolerant of certain things. Like, you know, I need more money now than I needed before. Like before, I would have done it very differently. Before, I would have been like, okay, well, I'll just be a lot poorer than I was, and, you know, I'll downsize and I'll eat ramen and all that sort of stuff. So I am not able to do that now, right? Like we need to have some sort of
stability.
And so my wife has a good job and so we wouldn't be able to do this right now. If I was a parent and we didn't have that as sort of a safety net, and like our income's dipping, but we still have a decent income. If I didn't have that, I wouldn't have done it. But on the other hand, I think being a parent also makes you feel like, well, there's something about it that was that I wanted to really own something, you know. And we rent our apartment; we don't own like a lot of people in New York. Mm-hmm. We rent our apartment, and I really wanted. I was feeling that sort of like I think this was sort of my nesting impulse. You know, sort of manifesting, you know, a lot of times when you're about to have kids, it's when you buy your first home or whatever, you really settle down in that sense. And I really wanted to build something that I owned. And I think that was partly also, I never thought about it before, but as you're mentioning that, I think that was partly what was behind
it. And I guess that drives some people. That's either a value or a craving that they have. And others, oh, I don't care about owning anything. I want to go to work and punch in, punch out and be done when I'm done.
And for many years, for decades, that was me. I would never have thought, like if you talk to the me of 25, you know, 25 or 30 or 35, I wouldn't have felt that way at all. You know, it might also have been just because I was an economics reporter for so long and, you know, studying business and sort of really sort of understanding like, you know, understanding like you know, I mean, there is a much more dramatic upside if you're right.
Although you first came to fame, if I might say, talking about the risks on Planet Money that, you know, that were reckless in the housing industry that blew up in 2008.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, people, you can be very reckless. And there's, you know, there's a lot of people saying that there's a sort of a bubble right now in the startup world, you know, that there's a lot of companies getting funded that perhaps shouldn't have been. And perhaps we were one of those. I personally don't think that we were.
Tech bubble two. You think we're in tech bubble two right now?
Yeah. It's not, I mean, nothing will be as bad as the housing bubble in terms of the overall economic impact it had. Housing was just so interwoven into every single corner of society. But yeah, I mean, there's, I'm not going to call it. Yeah. I don't know. And especially now, it's like, it's much easier to sort of like, back then I was sort of much more of an outsider. Now I'm deep inside it. And I have a much greater sympathy for people of like, when you're inside it, it's really, really hard to have any kind of,
perspective.
Perspective on it. Yeah, absolutely. Jacob, like on, whether it's a bubble or not. Yeah.
Jacob on the Upper West Side. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. And, you know, the subject that you were just talking about with having kids and being responsible, it actually fits into why I'm calling. I left a well-paying job 7 months ago to start my own startup, and my wife was on board. And, you know, in this time frame, we actually had bought a home and found out that we were pregnant.
Right. What do you mean, we, dude?
Well, that's
I know, I'm kidding.
You know, keep the boss happy. So we're selling the home now, and you know, obviously, if she wasn't completely on board with this, you know, my startup would never be made possible. But certainly doing this, I think, when you're married, you really need that co-founder, if I can call it that, your wife, to be on board, or it's not realistic.
Thank you very much, and so you bring your wife, Nazanin, who I know because she used to be here as a producer of On the Media, into your story.
Yes, very much. And very much it is, you know, a team undertaking. Like there is no way – we are doing this as a family, and there is no way to do it without a family. Not as a family. There's a way to do it without a family. If you don't have a family, you can do it. But I think if you have a family, it has to be – it's not something that one member does by themselves.
Right. The other kind of risk you're dealing with, or another kind of risk, is convincing investors to take a chance on you and your company. So I'm going to play a clip from your startup podcast of one of the investors you pitched who didn't commit any money to you necessarily, but maybe inspired some confidence. 35 seconds of Matt Mazzio, venture capitalist.
This one is interesting enough to me because I don't think there's many people with your pedigree willing to take a leap into entrepreneurship and who have the opportunity and the access to build brands as quickly and as effectively as you. And I think you've proven that you have an eye for content, which is, in my mind, really, really hard today. And so this fits into a bunch of things that we look for in a business, which is, you know, is this entrepreneur audacious and also probably the best at what they're going to go out and build? Yes. And so worthy of spending more time.
We said you have a pedigree.
Yeah. Like, you didn't play the butt, though. There was a big butt.
There is? The big butt was? What?
The big butt was, at that time, he said, we're interested in spending more time, but he did not commit, and he did not, you know, put any money into the company at that moment.
So why not after lavishing compliments on you?
Well, what I came to understand is sort of like it's in nobody's interest to sort of – when you're in these Yeah, there's a lot of things to say. Why not? He said, I think this got at something that a lot of the investors were worried about. If you're an investor, what you're looking for is a company not only that can be successful, like an investor, a nice profitable company that is growing slowly and steadily is often seen as a failure to a certain kind of investor who is looking for the next big thing. And so what they're looking at when they're looking at you is they're looking at, could you reasonably, you know, do you have a reasonable path to becoming huge, to becoming the next
These venture capitalists, they're not looking for a steady 6% return.
They're not looking for what they call a lifestyle business, which is something that is a very successful business that can make a lot of people a lot of money, but not they're not going to be $100 million, $200 million, $1 billion.
Mary in Brooklyn. Hi, Mary. You're on WNYC.
How are you?
Good. What's your story?
My story is a liquor store we opened up 6 years ago in Red Hook, Brooklyn, when an opportunity availed itself to us. And in that sense, the risk that was taken was going into a business that neither my husband nor I had ever had anything else to do with. But he was a longtime merchant, and I played around for a while. And we took advantage of a situation when the longtime and well-loved Linnell's down here closed. Mm.
And so, was it a risk, or okay, this is a liquor store, it's in a certain location, it's had this percentage of, you know, return or revenue every year, and you kind of really knew what you were getting yourself into?
No, not at all, because it was a neighborhood still when we did it 6 years ago that when we told our neighbors we were going to do this, they said, you're putting up the bulletproof window, aren't you?
In retrospect, it seems like really good timing, though. What did it pay off for you?
We're still here. We made it through Sandy. We're still paying bills. But what we have, again, gets back to what other people have said and what you consider a successful business. I'm not sure any investor is going to come along and expect, you know, say, let me take your plan and your model and make you a millionaire. But I'm not in it for that. I'm in it for the whole other gigabit, a place to live, to walk to work, to have my family.
Just the opposite of the venture capitalists.
Yeah.
And so either thing can motivate you to that risk. And guess what? Mary's story is the last word. We thank Alex Bloomberg, who is now the CEO of Gimlet Media and host of the Must Listen podcast, Startup, formerly of Planet Money and This American Life. Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brian.
And that is our family meeting on risk.